Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, Kristen Gross-Close will be telling us a little bit about the Smith-Kingsmore Syndrome Foundation.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the foundation's work?
Sure. Our foundation was started in August of 2019, and it was formed by a group of families whose children were diagnosed with Smith-Kingsmore syndrome. And that is a rare, ultra-rare genetic condition that was first written about in medical journals in 2013. So we started, a group of us found each other on social media, and we started this foundation, and our mission is to advance science to create a sunny world of hope for our patient families.
So, for those who might not be as familiar, tell me a little bit about how the syndrome typically affects a person.
Sure. Well, we're still learning a lot about the condition, and there is a spectrum of impairment. But a lot of our children have sleep disorders because the variant is on the mTOR gene, which controls the circadian clock. A lot of the patients have intellectual disability, sleep issues. Some have epilepsy. About half of the patient population at this point experiences that, and some autistic behaviors as well, and some have mobility issues too. So there are about, right now, we estimate about 200 patients globally diagnosed, but we expect that number to be much larger. Because the only way you can determine if you have Smith-Kingsmore syndrome is to have advanced genetic testing.
So I'd imagine that creates something of an issue when someone goes to their doctor and says, I'm having these symptoms, what could it be? If they're not familiar with it.
Yes. Yeah, it is very hard. And a lot of the patients who are diagnosed, most of them are children, which makes sense for genetic conditions because parents want to have answers. And once people reach a certain age, perhaps getting the testing is not as much of a priority. They might have received an autism diagnosis when they were younger, and they don't investigate further. A lot of our patients, the children are nonverbal, not everybody, but there are some who are mildly intellectually impaired and others who are more profoundly intellectually impaired. So it's a challenge for both the patient as well as the patient families, because when sleep doesn't just impact the individual, it impacts the caregivers. And it can also aggravate and exacerbate some of the symptoms that people may experience, such as the seizures or self-harm.
So in that sense, what are some of the supports the foundation offers to those who might be struggling with the question of, what does this mean for me? And is there anything I can do about it?
Well, yes. So our mission has been to fund scientific research. And so right now we are funding groundbreaking foundational research at the University of Florida, where they're trying to better understand all of these genetic variants within the mTOR gene to understand how it responds to certain conditions, with the goal being in the future precision medicine for the patients. So our mission is very focused on providing family support in the sense of connecting them with doctors, and if they have any questions, that we can find the information. We're in the midst of finalizing a patient information brochure, so that way families can kind of have an idea of what they should be concerned about and maybe specialists they need to bring in to help with their interdisciplinary team. And our foundation, though it may be young, we are working hard to provide greater information and reaching our global community. We are the recipient of a Chan Zuckerberg Initiative Rare as One grant, and that has been instrumental. We are building our capacity so that way we can better serve our community.
So, in your time with the foundation, what's been the greatest success moment you've experienced?
I would say there's been many, but I think when we've been able to tell our community that through their fundraising efforts, our grassroots efforts, that we are able to fund research at the University of Florida, we are going to be funding a third year of research. So we will be approaching over $177,000 that we have raised just by peer-to-peer fundraising to help support this research. And so I feel really proud that our small community of patients and families work really hard together to advance understanding of this often debilitating condition.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pressing forward in the research and the supports, what would you say?
Well, I would say that we need to keep looking for answers because there is so much that's unknown. And the mTOR gene impacts circadian clocks, so your sleep, but also, you know, it can impact epilepsy, aging, and cancer. So there's a lot of question marks. There's been some patients who have died from Smith-Kingsmore syndrome. And so it is imperative that we keep advancing the research forward, not just for our, you know, for our children in the future and future generations of people, but also because the research could have a broader impact beyond our small community. So that's what is so important. And maybe what they're understanding and learning about the circadian clocks can benefit the general population when it comes to sleep, or the broader autism community, who oftentimes sleep used to be kind of an afterthought, where a lot of people with intellectual disabilities have sleep issues, and doctors would just kind of, they didn't see the importance before, and they just, that was a secondary issue. But now our researchers are recognizing what a primary issue it can be from a neurodegenerative perspective, also a quality of life perspective for the patient and their families. So it's just really, really vital to keep the momentum going.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Vincenzo Bonavoto will be telling us a little bit about his work with neurofibromatosis. So, can you tell me a little bit about your work with neurofibromatosis?
I sit on the board of directors with the with the NFON, which is the Neurofibromatosis Society of Ontario. We run medical symposiums. We do annual camps for children and adults affected by neurofibromatosis, We also do a lot of fundraising events and just awareness events. So, and so I just help out with some of these kind of things.
So in terms of the camps for kids with this condition, got to imagine that it's kind of an eye-opening experience when they meet someone with it for the first time, feel a connection.
Oh, yeah. Like, my little boy, Sebastian, I remember, like, one of the first camps we had, he was just absolutely thrilled to be able to connect with other kids and adults, you know, that are living with neurofibromatosis, because, you know, in his community, like at school, let's say, there's only one other kid that has the disorder. So yeah, he met a lot of people there on the first one, and it's just amazing, even for the parents, right, to meet other people living with neurofibromatosis, and yeah, it was a very positive experience.
For those who might not be as familiar with the effects of neurofibromatosis, can you tell me a little about it?
So neurofibromatosis is a genetic disorder that causes tumors to grow on nerves. It's not as rare as people think. It's 1 in 2,500 births are affected by neurofibromatosis. And the effects, well, it causes tumors to grow on nerves. So one of the things that can happen, well, why don't we start at, like, if a parent has neurofibromatosis when they go to have a child, let's say, when they're conceiving, the baby has about a 50% chance of getting neurofibromatosis. If they can also show up as a spontaneous mutation, so that means that even if the parents don't have neurofibromatosis, it can just show up. It's chromosome 17, doesn't get coded properly. So that's Sebastian. That's what happened with him. His mother and I do not have neurofibromatosis, so that's how he ended up with it. And that was just again, they call it a spontaneous mutation. So from there, you move on and you think, you know, like, what can happen if you have neurofibromatosis? So what can happen is there's a plexiform neurofibromas, or a type of tumor, and they're, to keep it kind of simple, they're kind of spidered into all of your nerves depending where they show up. So he has a plexiform neurofibroma all on the left side of his face, and he has another one on the right tricep. Not everybody with neurofibromatosis has plexiforms, but they're one of the things that some patients, some neurofibromatosis patients, are affected by. The other thing is just regular neurofibromas are little tumors that grow on the skin. So a person who has neurofibromatosis, sometimes you can visibly see, because they have a lot of tumors, their skin is bumpy, and yeah, so that's, I mean, aside from all the other complications that can happen, it's pretty common also to have, like, Sebastian has, both of his optic nerves have neurofibromas on them, so there's just a higher risk of a lot of different types of things, you know?
So, how does NFON reach out to the patient community?
So, the organization, a lot of it is word of mouth and just spreading awareness. So we have an annual conference, and, you know, let's say there's a helpline. Like, when we first got our diagnosis, we were lucky. It was at 1 year of age. A lot of people don't get a diagnosis till, you know, later adulthood or early adulthood. So the first thing we did is we just typed in, you know, neurofibromatosis on Google, and the NFON website came up, and there was a phone number you could call. So when we called that number, you know, someone got back to us, and they kind of explained them what it is, and they provided support about who they are and how they could help support us. And so that's one way they reach out, because, you know, the minute, if you're someone living in Ontario, the minute that you get a diagnosis of neurofibromatosis, what, you know, you Google it and you'll see that organization. So they reach out that way with a website. They also reach out, you know, by community events. So, for example, we have Kempin Fest here in Barrie. So they've been there with a booth and you know, providing, spreading awareness. And then the camps, like I mentioned, and the conference is something that, the annual conference is something that is very kind of outreach oriented, because you know, that's the first thing we attended as parents, just to go and meet people and see what this organization is about. And then from there, you know, we were made aware of camps and, you know, Christmas events, this kind of stuff, all sorts of different things they do.
So, in your time with NFON, is there any success moment that stands out for you?
You know, it's been since about 2015 I've known of them. That's when I sat on the board. But it's been since about 2013 that I know of them. And the thing that stands out the most for me is when they started doing the camps, because again, it was such a success, and people came from even other provinces. And my son had a chance to, you know, play games and orient himself with other people with NF. So that's the biggest success for me personally. But there's a few other moments that stand out with research, like certain symposiums that we've had. We've had other, you know, London Sick Kids had a medical doctor speaking one time, and just seeing some of the advancements they're making in technology with vector technology and all sorts of stuff, it stands out in my brain too. Like that this neurofibromatosis has a bit of a, I don't know what word to use there, but a bit of a necessity in the medical world. So those two things kind of stand out for me with Neurofibromatosis Society of Ontario.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
So, in your time with your son and being part of the organization, have you ever encountered any myths or misperceptions concerning neurofibromatosis?
Yeah, one thing that stands out is that one time me and my son were doing some grocery shopping at Costco, and Sebastian is visibly different on the left side of his face. So I remember, you know, at the end of your Costco shopping, you know how they do the checking of your receipts, and we're kind of walking out, and the person there, the checker, was, you know, trying to be friendly, and they were like, hey, little guy, they're like, who punched your face? And everybody in the line heard, and everybody looked, and I just seen the kid's face drop, right? And it just, like, it absolutely broke my heart. So, you know, needless to say, after that, I'd give a little explanation to the checker as to, you know, what Sebastian was dealing with, and he felt bad, but, you know, I mean, what else do you do? You just try to educate people and try to let them know what neurofibromatosis is, and then, you know, obviously after, it's a talk with your son in the car and trying to build confidence and self-esteem. So, yeah, that stands out a lot.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for greater awareness, what would you say?
I would say, you know, hey, community, like, this is what 1 in 2,500 births in Ontario are dealing with, or in the world, sorry. And we really need to give some focus onto this, because the children need support, and they need people to advocate for them and their self-esteem and their self-respect. And yeah, like, give this some importance, because, you know, it can happen to anybody. So, you know, that's what I would say.
Thank you very much. Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Think you've heard it all? Think again. Indian beatmaster Ritesh Das brings you the latest sound exploration with Japanese taiko, Macedonian folk, and Canadian rock icon Biff Naked. You've got to hear it to believe it. Juno-nominated Toronto Tabla Ensemble's new album, For the Love of Tabla, is out now.
Freedom, run through me, like the sacred river.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Kristen Grossclose told us a little bit about Smith-Kingsmore syndrome, and we heard a little bit about neurofibromatosis from Vincenzo Bonavoda.
In this segment of our show, Taryn Patrikas will be telling us about the National Blood Clot Alliance. So, can you tell me a little bit about the Blood Clot Alliance?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been around for almost 20 years at this point, and we were founded back in 2003, and it was by a group of patients, as well as medical professionals actually together, who were attending a workshop at the CDC on the topic of blood clots, and they recognized this gap, and they set out to fill it by building a national organization to advocate for, to educate, to support really anyone who's been impacted by blood clots. And you know, now 20 years later, we're the leading patient advocacy organization in the U.S. for people who are both those impacted by blood clots as well as anyone who might be at increased risk for developing blood clots. For example, this could be anyone who has a family history of blood clots, cancer patients, injury, risks related to immobility, childbirth, and you know, that list goes on. But our focus is really on advancing the prevention of these life-threatening blood clots, as well as the early diagnosis and treatment.
So what are some of the common impacts of having a blood clot as far as overall health?
Yeah, well, you know, it depends on where it's located and how early you catch it. If you, you know, most oftentimes, this would develop in your leg, in the deep vein of your leg, called the DVT. And if you knew what to look for and you thought, okay, my leg's swollen, it's a little red, it's kind of, you know, feels like a Charlie horse almost, and you went to your doctor, they could easily treat that, and most often, you know, you would be fine. But if you let that progress and it's not caught early, that clot can break free and travel to your lungs, which is called a pulmonary embolism, and that's really when it becomes deadly.
So, these days, how does the Alliance go about reaching out to the patient community to let them know that your work is there?
Yeah, great question. We have an online support group where a lot of new patients find us and come in, you know, whether it's online through our website, through social media. So we do a lot of work in that space, recruiting patients and letting them know about our resources. But we're also supported by a medical and scientific advisory board. So these are leading physicians across the country who are, most of them are hematologists, so they're treating these patients. And, you know, through those connections with healthcare providers are also driving a lot of new patients to us and our resources.
So when you mention new patients coming in, do you ever find there are any myths or misperceptions surrounding blood clots?
Yes. One major one is that they only happen to old people. I think that, honestly, even on the side of healthcare providers, that misconception is really, you know, I hear it a lot, and leads to a lot of misdiagnoses because people, you know, are young or that they're too healthy to get a blood clot. You know, blood clots really don't discriminate. They can happen to anyone at any age, of any race, of, you know, anything. And if you have in your mind, you know, that you think this happens to people who are unhealthy or who are old, a lot of times that's where they're missed.
So in terms of the advocacy, how do you go about educating and clearing up these misperceptions?
Well, so in terms of public awareness, we work collaboratively with the CDC on some really targeted public education initiatives around this, and this could be through PSAs or you know, the different online digital advocacy. So you know, that's certainly one major way. Another way is that because we have such a large online community of patients and caregivers, it really is through encouraging them to speak out and share their story both with us and with their community. And those personal stories end up being a lot of times what we hear people coming in and saying, hey, I saw that you posted this story about so-and-so, and, you know, I realized that maybe I should go get something checked out. So That sort of organic word of mouth with patients stories is also really impactful.
So, in your time with the Alliance, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
You know, this past March, I would say I've been with the National Blood Clot Alliance since 2016. But this past March, we really, you know, we don't have a massive budget to put towards lobbying and all of that or other advocacy efforts, but we were taken on as a pro bono client by, you know, a major DC lobbying firm. And within a very, very short amount of time, we were able to make some really significant strides for the community and actually were able to get Congress to take notice. And after meeting with, I think it was more than 30 congressional offices throughout the month of March, which is Blood Clot Awareness Month, Senator Grassley and Lujan introduced it as a Senate resolution, and it was passed unanimously on the last day of March. So that was really, really significant. It will be, you know, officially recognized as Deep Vein Thrombosis and Pulmonary Embolism Awareness Month, which will really help bring attention to the issue and hopefully lay the groundwork for some additional funding to support blood clot awareness and education going forward.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward, what would you say?
You know, I think it's important that people who have experienced the blood clot and know about blood clots to realize that their one voice can make a really major impact and save a number of different lives. And I also think for the community who are impacted by blood clots, you know, this is something that I think a lot of people and a lot of medical professionals don't realize, you know, it alters your life and you leave the hospital with almost no information. So, you know, there's a lot of after effects of a blood clot. It is just one incident in some, you know, cases, but, you know, making sure that you're reaching out to find the appropriate resources and that you can resume, you know, your life as it was prior to the blood clot. But just make sure that you're educating yourself and that, you know, you're empowering yourself as a patient to advocate on your own behalf.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
You bet.
What an eye-opening experience it must be, my friends, for someone with a condition like neurofibromatosis to realize in an instant they're not the only one who's affected by this. When you're not dealing with a household name condition, you can come to that conclusion that I'm the only one like me out there. But we all long for that sense of community, feeling of connection, to being understood by those similar backgrounds and experiences. One of the most important things in all of disability life is to take the ideas that are presented to us and to build on them, accepting, of course, the idea that nothing is possible for you and that there's no hope. That one should be immediately discarded. But if another comes to you and says, I found this innovative way of doing things, or I had this insight about my condition, we should take it to heart, see if it makes sense to us, see if we can grow in our own evolution as a person with a disability. The fact is, it's affecting one person, it's affecting others out there. And a lot of the smaller organizations I've heard from over time, they've put a lot of time, effort, and heart into finding those similar stories. And honestly, there is nothing more important than making that connection, building that bridge. Because in community, you start to see that there's hope for any situation. Yeah, there might not be an immediate cure, but steps in that direction, mutual support, that can be a very powerful thing. And ultimately, it can cause the world to take notice, to put any disability on the global stage, where it is acknowledged, and having people work upon it is always key. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.